Welcome to this podcast of Sunday nights on ABC Local Radio. I hope you enjoy the program. Our regular film commentator, Father Richard Leonard. He's author of a book on the films of Peter Weir, and he'll join us to discuss Peter Weir's vision in Gallipoli. And to introduce him, the unforgettable music associated with Weir's film, Albinoni, the Adagio. Albinoni, the Adagio, identified in the public mind these days with one thing. It's iconic of Peter Weir's film Gallipoli. And our guest this evening, a regular, Father Richard Leonard, has some particular interest here. It was the subject of his PhD. Richard Leonard, welcome.
Thank you, John. Great to be here.
A book, an entire book on Peter Weir, his films, and a very special place for Gallipoli in that story. It betokens a lot about Peter Weir, this story, but let's put it in its wider context. Why did he choose this film to get interested in, and why has it become so iconic for Australians as a symbol of the heights of the Australian film industry?
It's an extraordinary story. Peter Weir, I did my PhD on Peter Weir, and this is a chapter of my PhD. And later I published it as a book with Melbourne University Press. And so I've watched this film about 86 or 88 times. I think I have lost count now, but I've been moved by it 86 times. It's still an immensely powerful film. But the story of it is extraordinary. Peter Weir is a pacifist, and he was as angry as most Australians were in the 70s about the Vietnam War. And yet he was encouraged by a friend of his to visit Gallipoli on the way to Europe in 1976. And he goes to Anzac Cove in February of 1976. And I want to read a little bit from something he wrote. It's a bit long, but stay with me because it really is the beginning of this being a mystical experience for this preeminent director. He says in his diary from February of 1976, "It was a hot, sunny day, and I threw off my clothes and swam at Anzac Cove, and then I walked up Shrapnel Gully. There was nothing on my mind, and I began to feel I was being watched. There was no one around, so I shrugged the feeling off. But the further I went up the gully, the more certain I was that I was being watched or even being followed. I thought, this is crazy, this is ridiculous. And then I spoke out loud. I said, 'Who's there?' I said it louder. I said, 'Hello.' I said, 'Cooey,' to bring the person out, whoever it was. Anyway, the feeling was claustrophobic, so I started saying things like, 'My name's Peter Weir.' I went on a bit further and thought, 'I'm going mad, it must be the sun.' So I busied myself taking a few photographs, drawing a map of the area for the locations back in Australia, and then I found myself saying again, 'I'm Peter Weir. I'm 32 years of age. I'm an Australian.' And then I said strongly, almost spontaneously, 'I know who you are, and I know you're watching me. I don't know whether to do this film. I don't know whether it's right to do. You're strangers to me, fellow countrymen, but I've been thinking of making a film about you. I'll do the right thing by you. I won't let you down. I wouldn't harm what you did here, because I know what you did here. If you're with me, show me your secret things. Help me.' The feeling went. Then minutes later, I found a can opener, a knife and a fork, a pair of shoes, some bullets and a bomb, even a bottle of Eno's fruit salts unbroken, which I brought home. So I just hurried away. And that night, I went to a little Turkish inn, sat there, and burst into tears. I just wept as I'd never had before, a sort of sad crying, a kind of gland thing, a physical release with the sudden understanding that history was something that really happened, and those countrymen had really actually died suddenly. So I swore a pact with the ghosts, that I do the film. That's the beginning of Gallipoli. And it's the man's had a mystical experience, something, an experience of otherness, of something quite extraordinary and outside. So this most iconic of films ends up starting with what we would say to be a quasi-religious experience. Peter certainly wouldn't express it as a religious experience, but as a priest in a study of mysticism, I certainly would. And most Australians don't know that.
And it's a thread that is consistent through many of his films, from The Last Wave right through.
A lot of his films are about disappearing. The girls disappear on the rock. White guy disappears into Aboriginal Dreamtime. A young man disappears into Shakespeare and Dead Poets Society. People disappear in Master and Commander. They've disappeared in The Way Back. So there's a big thing of entering a much bigger narrative and then disappearing, sometimes into nature and sometimes into mythology. And Gallipoli brings together a number of those elements. That's why it's such a mystical text.
Why do you think it stayed as such an iconic film in the Australian psyche?
I think it performs a number of different functions. Firstly, it was a film that came out of the period stuff. So we were making lots of period films in the mid to late 70s. My Brilliant Career, Picnic at Hanging Rock. And so this is another period film. The other one, it picked up on that strong sense in the early 80s of Australians now becoming adventurous, that all of a sudden young people from the early 70s on started to have their own money. And that led them to be financially independent of their parents. And one of the big manifestations of that is Europe on $5, $10, $20, $50 a day. They started to become backpackers and went, and in fact, after this film, ended up going to Gallipoli, but that's another story. And also, it's a film all about national mythology. So three wonderful things come together into that. So we're exploring our own history and story, the period stuff. We're talking to a present generation who's starting to be adventurous. It's an adventure story. And also, it's about trying to find out who we are right now. And that film tries to locates itself within each of those three ways.
It was a critical moment in the national mythology too, with the emergence of the baby boomers as adults in the late 60s, early 70s. And you had plays like The One Day of the Year, Alan Seymour's play, which was grappling with the breaking of almost the stranglehold that a version of the national myth, the soldier myth, had on a generation, the father and son clash about what are we celebrating here? And we as a pacifist, dealing with that same material, but coming at it far more sympathetically than, say, Alan Seymour did in his play.
I think we've got all sorts of things emerged in the 70s. The Vietnam War was defining for us because we had people, soldiers who came back, who were spat upon, didn't feel welcomed, they didn't have a homecoming parade. And we've been dealing with the appalling fallout from that dreadful national response ever since. As angry as people were about our involvement in that war, the treatment of veterans who came back was an absolutely national scandal. You know, they did what the government told them to do, and therefore a nation, I think, at least owes them some respect and thanks for that. For instance, one of the things I've always liked saying about this film is Peter Weir saved Anzac Day. Like, Anzac Day numbers, the people turning out for dawn services and Anzac Day parades by the late 70s and early 80s were so small that there was some conversation about whether we could go on to have the streets of national cities being hijacked for very small numbers. People forget this, but the feeling in the country was so anti-war, anti-defence force, that there were only the old-timers and people grieving for lost relatives who would turn up. This film comes out in July of 81, not in time for Anzac Day, I don't even miss that, but from July of 81 to then Anzac Day of 1982, Anzac 82 was the largest turnout of numbers seen in living memory. And the only thing that had happened between 81 and 82 was this magnificent film. And there we all of a sudden, we got the story again in a way that a whole generation could embrace it. Now, this film has been heavily criticised because it is a bit of hagiography. David Williamson, most people don't know this, but David Williamson, the great Australian playwright, wrote the screenplay. We wrote the story. Williamson writes the screenplay, and they based it on two books, Bean's The Anzac Book, the famous book, but Bean was at pains to make out Australians were always heroic and always wonderful and Now, we know from his own diaries that he edited out a lot of the material that he didn't know. But Bill Gammage also wrote a fantastic book called The Broken Years. Now, that was an unedited collection of diary entries from the soldiers themselves. They were terrified. They had to be pistol-whipped to get out of those trenches. People maimed themselves. They shot themselves. People maimed each other so that they might get the hell out of Gallipoli, get off it. And that doesn't take anything away from those men now. But for Australia, we wanted the heroic story and we got it. Weir gets criticised because, and Williamson somewhat, because they tended to go for the former reading rather than the latter reading. So these are rather heroic individuals, although Frank does embody the Mel Gibson character. He embodies a guy who doesn't want to go over and didn't want to be there. And then we get the absolutely heroic Archie, who takes his place and ends up, of course, not only running to his death, but running into cultural mythology as the heroic sacrificial offering on a Gallipoli beach.
That picks up two other threads of Australian literature that had been there all along. That is the mateship myth, which had been sort of propagated through that time. It also picks up the darker side of the Australian myth, the sort of pointless death, the death in the desert. It's the opposite to the American frontier myth.
Yes. For us, deserts are a very important part of our canon of literature and film. If you think about the number of stories that are located in deserts in this country, now we are the most urbanised country in the world and we have a mythology of the outback. Most people don't go there.
Barcroft Boak, out where the dead men lie.
Yeah, that's
it's
right.
It's picking up all of that as well.
Well, Voss and Burke and Wills and Leichhardt and on it goes. And think about a good number of our, like even Crocodile Dundee, for something much more popular. It's about a world Australians romanticise, don't know an awful lot about. Like when we go on holidays, the vast majority of Australians, where do they go? The beach. They go to the water. And yet we continue to have this great romance and sense of that our identity is somewhat forged. And it has been for a certain group and primarily for our Indigenous brothers and sisters. But it's not the white story, and yet so many of our white narratives have been located in the desert.
It's the opening of A.D. Hope's film. You know, they call David Hope's poem, they call her a young country, but they lie.
David Tacey wrote a terrific book, a wonderful article a few years ago about the desert as a transformation. It's a place of transformation, and either for ruin, so the transformation could be that, you know, you get your physical limits and die, or where you come back enlightened. And of course, what mystical texts do, and that's what I do in the book I wrote for Melbourne University Press, and that's what I did in my doctorate, is to show that a mystical film starts with a mystical text. Well, of course, in the Old and New Testament, the desert profoundly performs this function. So you get the Israelites in the desert for 40 years. You get Jesus in the desert for 40 days and 40 nights. And even though Gallipoli is on a beach, for those of us who have ever been there, it's a very desert beach. It's a bit like Australia, and like they shot Gallipoli, the film, in South Australia.
Yes, and the recent one they shot down on the Mornington Peninsula.
The Water Diviner. Yeah, they went back there because we've actually, our beaches are located very close to what, you know, go up one hill and you're into a desert. So it's a very deserted sort of style of vegetation that you find there. And so in this desert, we get this New Testament, Old Testament motif going on behind it. Is transformation. And there are two transformations that happen in this film. Archie, who becomes the heroic national mythological figure of sacrifice, and Frank. And Frank has to come home to keep Archie's memory alive. They both perform an incredibly important function. That's not in the film, but it's pregnant in the film. It's what gets born after the film, that Frank screams as Archie is shot to his death and has taken his place. That should have been Frank. So it's no greater love has a man or a person than this to lay down their lives for their friends. So it's picking up all of these other narratives. And then I explore in my book and in the study of this film all the other things that are there that people interested in religion would always see. You've got the desert, but death is everywhere in this film. You've got great motifs like the River Styx, that beautiful scene where they go on the boat arriving. When they arrive at Gallipoli, it's like a carnival. There are like fireworks happening, but they're actually bombs going off, and there are boats festooned with it looks carnivalesque, but then the next morning they have to arrive on the beach. And if ever there was a wonderfully contemporary Australian thing of the crossing of the River Styx, and it's deftly used. If Weir didn't know he was using it explicitly, boy, it's implicitly there, because Achilles becomes immortal by crossing the River Styx. Well, so's Archie going to become immortal too. And it was the River of Death, where two rivers come together and you've got power and courage to be able to cross them and to come back alive. And Achilles becomes immortal as a result. But also you've got the athletic stuff. So we've got all that 2 Timothy things of the runner and the race and claiming the prize. Remember at the beginning of this film, there's a great moment where Archie's little brother or little sister, I just forget, I should know because I've seen the film so often, but he says, come home with a medal. Now he's going off to run a foot race in Perth. And, well, he does come home with a medal, but it's the medal of immortality. It's the medal of having distinguished by becoming a soldier after the race was over. And then the final one that's there all the way through, of course, is crossing the Valley of Death. So, you know, we've got the hills and valleys of the trenches, and even explicitly, we've got a soldier in the last scene of the, one of the last scenes of the film, praying Psalm 23. If I walk through the valley of death, I shall not fear. They're petrified before the whistle sends them over. So I don't think it's too much of a stretch to say that whether it was implicit or explicit, there are so many other mystical texts that are being employed here and explored in terms of a national theology and mythology as well.
Weir doesn't put this one in his canon of sort of great mythical exploration films, though, does he? He sort of regards this as more a sort of a narrative story that he was telling and wanted to tell it with some integrity. But he
well, to be honest, John, I've never heard him talk about a narrative of mystical texts. I would like to, because I wrote a doctorate on it, but certainly there are others that might immediately suggest something a little more profound, like Picnic at Hanging Rock, The Year of Living Dangerously. These are quite explicitly otherworldly texts, but that doesn't worry me at all. I think this is all about redemption and self-sacrifice, atonement, like even offering up our young men for the sake of the mother country, in this case, for God, king and country. You know, I'm quite struck by the fact, by the way, that in the whole Gallipoli centenary, we keep hearing for our country and for our king and country that this was one of the great cries, the rallying cries of World War One. I'm very interested in secular Australia. They've left out God. That in actual fact, if you go back, as I did when I was doing the research on this film, and you read the sort of promotion literature, it was almost always God, king and country. And when you heard the prime ministers of the day, when you heard the king call people to come and into the Great War, they always talked about God, king and country. And it fascinates me, and I don't want to let this go. I'm not saying that it's interesting that even when we want to quote something from World War One, a secular Australia now just uncomfortable there with God, so drop it. Mm-hmm. And it ends up king and country. Well, it wasn't for people of 1914, 1915. Mm-hmm. And God, king and country was very strong, front and centre for that generation.
In fact, Philip Jenkins, the biblical scholar from the United States, has just written or just published a book called The Great and Holy War about World War One, which identifies the way in which countries did manipulate the God story for their own purposes.
This one's it's all there for everybody to see and hear.
Why does it continue to resonate? Is it that a generation beyond the Vietnam War generation have bought into the romantic mythology, or is it something else?
I think that we quickly turned in the 80s then. We had a couple of things. One is that I think we wanted a national identity. We're still struggling for that, and we still are to a degree. So we're still searching for what does it mean to be Australian. And, of course, the funny thing about the Gallipoli story is it was an unmitigated disaster. It was a failure. And it's interesting that we've reclaimed it as a national mythology story, not of great courage, like the War of Independence or, you know, some other great victory, but it becomes a story of great courage, that these men went to war, and the women, the nurses and others who accompanied them, and the chaplains, I want to put in a bit of a plug for them. They often get left out of the whole discussion too, but all sorts of ancillary and other support groups too. But nonetheless, they went to their death heroically. They were sacrificial, and they were courageous.
But they're sacrificial lambs against something else. It's not just against the Turks. It's against the bosses in society. It's the upper ranks always get sort of bagged out, and it's the real troopers who get the job done. And that's a national psyche thing too. Whether it's Ned Kelly, whether it's Farlap, these are all great disasters which we take heroic courage from because it's the battler winning through. Even Whitlam is November the 11th.
I think too that here, you know, the people are very angry at the film Gallipoli were the English, of course. They really objected to the way that British soldiers were presented in the film. And in actual fact, they have a bit of a case because the person who, like this is based on a real story, this film, the 17th of August 1915, where the 8th and 10th Light Horse Divisions from Western Australia were sent over on the Battle of the Neck or the Siege on the Neck. And in the film, it is certainly, the colonel who sends them over and orders them to go, and it's just a slaughter, and it was a slaughter on that day, is in fact portrayed as a Brit. He's got a very British accent. In actual fact, it was an Australian. Now, I don't think our uniforms were any different from the British in those days, so they can be forgiven. Well, not forgiven. They're historically accurate in having the same uniform. But he has a terribly British accent. And you will send them over now, you know. And the Brits rightly, I think, saw that, well, we weren't the only ones part of this discussion. And while they, you know, Winston Churchill and others have to take a fair bit of responsibility for the disastrous campaign that was the Gallipoli offensive, you know, the Australian hierarchy were up their neck. So it is it's the beginning of a go of, well, not the beginning of the go, it's the continuation of the story as we aren't British. We stand on our own feet. And the one thing that World War One tells us is that that was the beginning of the separation. It was a separation narrative that while we were there to serve God, King and country, then by the end of that campaign, we weren't going to do this. We weren't doing it on your terms anymore. We certainly continued to support Britain, obviously, in World War II, but we started to find our own voice. So it is the beginning of an Australian identity, and that's one of the reasons I think it resonates. The other thing is I think it does say something about courage. It says something about mateship, of hanging in there with people in the darkest and worst times. I'd like to think that at our best we're still good at that. I don't know that it's particularly Australian. I don't want to claim it as only ours, but I'd like to think at our best we still see it in floods and droughts and disasters and fires where people really do step up and do heroic things for one another. In the trenches of a fire or a drought, maybe the Gallipoli mythology still works out. We're not so self-interested that the only person we think of in a disaster is ourselves. So I think there are things that still encourage us and call us to greater acts of self-sacrifice, and that's good.
A challenge to perhaps the individualism that we've become obsessed with.
Yes, there's certainly, and in this film, of course, those trenches are communities, you know, and I love a Bill Hunter character, who is their sergeant. No, he's an officer, and he'll go over as well. He has to go over because he wouldn't ask the men to do a single thing. One of the delicious moments in this film, which is where Weir is such a wonderful architect of these scenes, where he has the Bill Hunter character listening to the in-depths of the temple, you know, which is about two men professing their lifelong love for each other in that great opera. And then, you know, there's a fire and one dies. And so all of these things are so multi-textural. Other texts are being disclosed all the way through, and the 23rd Psalm and one guy saying the rosary and all sorts of things are happening there. But it's a community. They're going to do it together. And that's one of the great motifs of the film, that Archie gets Frank on board because you've got to be in it. You've got to do it together. So, I think it's also saying something about death. I think by the early 80s and maybe even now, we're a death-denying culture. We no longer have dead people at home. We're not allowed. We don't go to funeral homes in the way that other cultures do. We don't visit cemeteries. Death has become very cleaned up. It's become clinicalized. We don't want to see dead people. Images may disturb you, we hear now recurrently, and with good reason. But it's all about not seeing death. And this film is replete with death. And all about the pyramids, how they were I'm quoting from the film now, man's first monument to cheat death, to try and cheat death. We've already talked about the deserts. We've got Archie being lifted up, which is a Moses and Jesus moment in the film. So it's all about confronting mortality and then the immortality that might come out of it as a result. extraordinary, and innocent death too, and that is always still touching. Archie is such a boyishly beautiful, innocent, abroad, literally, and he's offered up in a national sacrifice.
Richard Leonard, great to talk with you. And if you want to look more at Richard's work on the mystical gaze of the sinner of Peter Weir, the book's available from MUP. Richard Leonard, thanks so much again for joining us.
Thanks, John. It's a great pleasure and honour to be with you, particularly on this Anzac Day weekend.
This has been a podcast of Sunday Nights on ABC Local Radio. Thank you for listening.